If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Rohan Nadkarni, joined today, making a repeat appearance on the show, but it's our first time doing it together. I think he's one of the most beloved NBA writers in our little NBA community. The most prolific writer I've ever seen. He's a senior writer at Yahoo Sports. Dan Devine is on the show. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm much better after that glowing introduction. I don't know that I deserve it, but I'll take it greedily. And the fact that there was apparently a clamoring for my return from the Open Floor Globe, like I'm stunned, but I'm humbled and I'm here. So let's dig in.
We used to do this. We got an email, like Herring and I last week talked for about like Halloween costumes for 9 minutes, and we got an email that was like, hey, you guys really took way too long to get into basketball. My bad. But I just want to throw out there that we used to do this TV web show for SI, and we'd get like really random B, C list, D list, like quote unquote celebrities on the show. And the thing I took pride in the most was my introductions. That's what I want to be remembered for, is like when I introduce someone, I really introduce them.
And you had like a low talent co-host, right? Like a real like someone who like tanked the quality of those videos. A guy named Matt Dollinger, I think.
They had to replace him. He was so bad. I'd never seen anything like it.
Truly disappointing.
Yeah, that's so funny. Oh, wait. All right, Daniel, let's not anger. I got to see who wrote in this email. It was so, he sent like a screenshot and everything. Like, took you guys so long to get into, all right, let's not anger Daryl Swenson. Daryl, apologies. Apologies, brother. Dan, let's get right into it today. So much stuff going on in the NBA already. On and off the floor, we're not even 10 games into the season, and it feels like the season's lasted a lifetime. Unfortunately, I know people want to start with basketball talk, but we got to talk about this Kyrie Irving situation that's developed over the last few days since we recorded. Basically, Kyrie posting a link to an anti-Semitic movie on Amazon, a movie containing a lot of anti-Semitic tropes. Kyrie not exactly apologizing for it, doubling down on it. He had an exchange with Nick Friedell over the weekend after a Nets loss to the Pacers, kind of defending his right to post that and complaining that people focus on you know, his bad posts and not his good posts. Or it was a kind of a strange defense. You know, obviously this is now the umpteenth kind of Kyrie Irving controversy. You know, not to like self-promote here, I tweeted like, this is such a bad look for the Nets and the NBA. Like, you don't want players after a basketball game defending their right to share Alex Jones' Instagram posts and saying that his conspiracies are true. Like, this is just like embarrassing for everyone involved here. Like, you know, I more than anyone would love to talk about just basketball. And now, you know, we have like back and forth with a star player, one of the most recognizable faces in the league, going back and forth with a reporter, kind of like his right to post nonsense on the internet. Dan, I guess I'll just start with like, what have you made of the situation so far? And do you think it's kind of being handled properly?
Well, the first thing that I thought of was, as Kyrie got to the end of that kind of combative interaction with Nick Friedel of ESPN, was he's like, can we get a basketball question? Can we just talk about basketball? I'm like, are you guys sure you want to talk about basketball right now? Because y'all suck. Like, you're
yeah.
1-5 with by far the worst defense in the NBA. And like the whole team concept of you plus Kevin Durant equals buckets and vibes has really failed you. Like, this is not something to be like, if you want to talk about that on a long enough timeline, you might just wind up wanting to talk about this stuff too. Like, I don't think there's much solace for you to be found there.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a certain aspect of it feels like fighting your own shadow or trying to grab hold of smoke trying to argue about Kyrie. Like, there's no sort of logical endpoint to the discussion. There won't be a do you see why this is hurtful or why this is a problem? Oh, yes, I understand your point of view. And now let me redress that, or let me reconsider and make an amends off of that. You've got someone who's sort of circularly arguing in these answers. Like, I have this incredible influence. I have this army behind me. I have all of this import in what I say. Also, everything I say is the same as everybody else, and I have the same right to say it as anybody else, and you shouldn't pay any attention to it, and fame is a construct. But also, I am singularly important to this larger community and to the human race. Like, and so there's this sort of, then what are we doing? Like, what you want, it seems like, is the freedom to say whatever you want, which you have, and also the freedom from any sort of pushback or consequence or criticism from that, which you don't. You know, like, there's no reasonable expectation that what you say should be completely divorced from any kind of commentary or response to it. And so that, unfortunately, is something that the Nets have come to learn over the last several years. It's part of it. And the calculation that they have continued to make is that all of it's worth it so long as Kyrie balls. And Kyrie's averaging 30 points a game. He's shooting 60% inside the arc. I don't know that you would necessarily say he's the reason that they're not winning, but also they're not winning. They have an average offense and a terrible defense with him playing about as well as he's played since he put on that uniform. So then at what point does it become not worth the problem anymore?
Especially, it's like he's on an expiring deal. This whole experiment's been teetering since the summer. I think it was Bomani Jones was like, they need to just waive him and blow this up. And at first I was like, that's crazy. And the more I thought about it, I was like, really, what are they doing here? You know, Joe Tsai doesn't seem to be a fan of anyone on the team. He can certainly afford it. And beyond that, I also, you know, it's also just been frustrating because not only, like you said, Kyrie wants to have it both ways. He wants to be this kind of person who uses his platform, voice for the voiceless, but then he's like, nope, I just exist. Try to have it both ways. But beyond that, you know, the NBA posts this incredibly, it was embarrassing. Like, it was more embarrassing that they released the statement that they did than had they not released one at all, where they release a statement that is, you know, seemingly in reference to Kyrie Irving, where they condemn anti-Semitism, but they spell it wrong in the statement. They don't name Kyrie. You know, it was just weak and ineffective. And going back to like kind of that exchange that we witnessed over the weekend, it's like, just suspend him for a game, like do something. You can't have this be the focus of a post-game press conference or a focus at all. You know, Kyrie, I think, finally deleted the tweet I think either yesterday or today, after leaving it up for so long. And you make a good point. It's like, you know, the Nets have been willing to put up with all this, the vaccine, you know, refusal, all these things, because, you know, even that they put up a little bit of a stand. But when they said, oh, we look like we're not going to win as many games as we thought, let's get him back in the lineup, they fold. You know, and where has it gotten them? You know, first round sweep. Right. Now this year the team's been terrible. Like, is this all really worth it? I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing with that is, like, it gets to a point where, what are you building on? What is the foundation of what your organization's supposed to be, right? If you think about teams that have won championships in recent years, you can look at it and say, well, like, the Warriors are based on a consistently elite defense and Stephen Curry's leadership and the way that his unique skill set warps the geometry of the floor, but also the standard he holds that team to. And everybody else has to rise to meet mm-hmm. that standard, or they don't last, right? The Bucks win the championship with an elite defense, and then Giannis Antetokounmpo setting that standard of, I am relentless, I am hardworking, I am going to break down the wall, literally and metaphorically, and if you do not reach that standard, you will not last. This is what we are built around. What are the Nets built around? What is, and when you get to the core of what that is there any there? Mm-hmm. And I think where I'm, so I wrote a little bit about this on something that'll be up at Yahoo Sports soon, and, like, I think that where we come back to is, like, if you want to talk about just the basketball of it, your team isn't built on anything.
Yeah. You're,
there was a time where there was a focal point of, like, we're going to build everything around the three-man action of KD and Kyrie and James Harden. And the result of that was
a fantastic offense, the best offense we've ever seen. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that could have continued to be something. But the interpersonal dynamic of that, and whatever reasons that James Harden decided he wanted to leave, which reportedly, and depending on who you talk to, like, the fact that Kyrie was refusing to get the vaccine had played a role in that, and the just realizing maybe that this was not quite what he had signed up for played a role in that. And so then that falls away. Okay, so now we're based on these two and Ben Simmons. And Ben Simmons is going to paper over the defensive shortcomings, and he's going to be, we're going to just assume that anybody can be Draymond Green, I guess, because that's not a hard thing to be, and that Ben Simmons is going to do that. Okay, well, can you rely on that? Can you rely on that when you're relying on somebody coming back off of 16 months not playing for multiple reasons? And where's the leadership that's going to set the standard that we have to go together with? I went to Barclays for the opening night game against the Pelicans, and it blew my mind. After they got their doors blown off, Steve Nash is like, we have to raise our standard of competitiveness. We have to establish and raise a competitive standard. It's opening night, and your team that has championship expectations, why do you not already have that? Is that from the coaching? Is that from the in the locker room player leadership? Is it because Kevin Durant kind of doesn't want to be that sort of leader? And then in a vacuum, whatever else fills that space. I don't know, but, like, what you keep coming back to is just, like, there, I don't think there's content in the middle of that. No, I mean, there's content being shared, and there's content, there's plenty of clips, but, like, I don't know that there's any real basis for what their team's built around. And if that's the case, you're not going to be able to stand up to the Bostons and to the Milwaukees and to the Golden States and to whoever else on that you would need to beat on the way to something serious.
Really well said. And, you know, getting back to the, I think, basketball aspect of it, talk about Steve Nash quotes after the Pacers loss. They lose to a Pacers team that, while has been frisky, is, like, largely believed one of the teams that's going to tank most in the NBA. I mean, so far the Nets have only won once. Steve Nash called it a disaster, the loss a disaster to the Pacers. They've been really bad. Their starting lineup's one of the worst units in the league. You know, I wrote about them playing Simmons more at the five. It can work a little bit. You know, Herring and I talked about it quite a bit last week, although it does open up some defensive concerns. On the court, you know, they play the Pacers again today. I have to imagine they're going to win. They're at home. But, you know, do you see any kind of salve for them on the court? Is there, or do you have a reason to be optimistic about this team? Joe Harrison, Seth Curry, you know, Seth Curry finally coming back over the weekend. Like, is there anything from that perspective that you feel good about when it comes to the Nets?
Yeah, I mean, the glass half full take is, you know, well, they opened up with a brutally hard schedule, you know, like five really good teams. And then the Pacers loss is kind of inexcusable. They were on, you know, the Pacers were coming on the road on the second night of a back-to-back without like three rotation players. And they gave up 23 three-pointers to that team. Yeah. Like, that is just, that's a game you can't lose.
They gave up 125 points to the Indiana Pacers at home.
To a team that everybody is sort of anticipating, just when are the wheels going to fall off for them, and are they going to start, you know, building toward the future? But what we're learning is, like, if you are, if you're not serious, you can get the brakes beat off you by a team that is just willing to try and play harder than you. And so the glass half full, the glass got empty there. We'll go back to the glass half full side, is that you had a really brutal start, and now you've got, you know, another game with Indiana. The Bulls have been better than people anticipated, but, you know, the Wizards and the Hornets and some games coming up against teams that have been struggling. They go out on a West Coast road trip, but that'll be, you know, a Clippers team that has struggled in the early going, a Lakers team that struggled in the early going, Sacramento. So there are opportunities here as the schedule kind of levels off for them to, you know, move back toward a sort of a more solid footing. Combine that with they're expecting a lot, or they were relying a lot on guys who are coming back off of injury. You mentioned Joe Harris, Seth Curry, TJ Warren is, I don't know if TJ Warren's ever going to play for them, but maybe at some point he would be somebody that could come back and fill a role for them. Simmons, again, there's that Nash and others have talked about just that, the rust and the ability to get back to being physical and the full speed of the game while also being required to defend number one options. And it's a tricky job. Maybe that is something that gets a little bit easier for him with time. They're going to figure out their rotations a little bit better. As you said, it's not just moving to Simmons at the five. It's also figuring out ways you can split up him and Nick Claxton. You know, that was something, like, they're still going to start that lineup, it looks like, but they're playing about half as often together as they did in the first couple of games.
This is my biggest pet peeve, by the way, when NBA teams do that. It's like, we're starting a lineup we know is not good and or our best lineup. And I understand there are some rotational concerns. Sorry to cut you off, but it's just annoys me so much when teams are like, we know this lineup is bad, but for some reason we feel like we have to play it. It's like, why? It's like, it goes back to when the Thunder would start Kendrick Perkins in the 2012 NBA Finals. It's like, why are you, like, handcuffing yourself when you do not have to, when this data is so present, it's so easy. It just truly angers me, Dan.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can see your passion. I want you to chill out a little bit. But what I would say is, like, it is, I mean, you need to figure out what you have, right? And the reality is, like, they didn't have any time to figure that out. Had Ben Simmons been able to play in the back half of last season, maybe they would have, or after the trade deadline last season, maybe they would have gotten some, you know, early data about what it's going to look like. You can conceptually say, I don't think two non-shooters is going to work, even if you've got KD and Kyrie, and, you know, insert Royce Young, insert Seth Curry, insert Joe Harris, whomever's going to be the third wing there. But, like, we need to see it, because we think that this is, if we are going to have any hope of protecting the rim, clearing the glass, having any kind of interior presence, Nick Claxton's probably going to need to be part of that. So then how do we, and then, like, the entire concept of what holes we're plugging on the team requires Simmons to be there too. So, like, we got to see how it works. And then the answer is, like, it can barely score a point per possession and it's getting its doors blown off on defense. Okay, so now we've seen that and we can say, well, now we gave it the old college try and we've got to figure out what else to do. The sneaky problem that they have, though, is just until all of those other guys are healthy enough to contribute in a major way, what other answers do they have? You know, like, De'Ron Sharpe is not going to dramatically change the fortunes of the team when you're looking at those two big lineups. Going more to Patty Mills makes you even smaller and more likely to get more susceptible at the point of attack, and then you're giving up straight line drives at the rim, which you can't protect, and giving up second chance points because you can't clear the defensive glass. So, like, the way their team is built is with bigs who don't necessarily fit together and small guards, and you don't have a whole lot in the middle and a whole lot of the ballast to kind of tie all that together. And when that's the case, you're going to be a bad defense who needs to outscore people. And right now, they're the only team in the league that has two 30-point scorers, and they're still an average offense. Like, the math ain't mathin' right now. And that's like the challenge for them is, I don't know how, I mean, we can argue whether or not Steve Nash is the tactician for this job. We can argue whether or not You know, Simmons just needs to be a different version than he has been thus far to make this all click. But there also might not be a whole lot of answers. And if that's the case, and when what you're watching in terms of the basketball team isn't compelling or positive, everything else gets louder. And when the stuff that's being said is as like venomous and nasty, or the stuff that's being shared is as abhorrent and despicable as what has been shared,
yeah.
then and you turn the volume up on that, then like nobody wants to hear what's coming out of there.
I agree. And the Nets.
It would be amazing if you be amazing if you didn't. If you were like, I'm going to zag on you.
You know what? I think they are going to turn it around. I kind of had some faith in this team before the start of the season, and I just regret it. I like they seduce me every time, and I'm just sick of them. I'm so sick of them. That I would like to move on to
please
some other things I'd like to talk about today. Let's start in the Western Conference now, where the Golden State Warriors have lost two games in a row to the Hornets and Pistons. They're getting some good cover from the Nets right now because those are not great losses for a team of the Warriors' caliber. The Nuggets just lost to the previously winless Lakers on Sunday night. The Clippers, we talked about them last week. They dropped two in a row to the Thunder. They haven't looked great. Obviously, they're dealing with this Kawhi injury, which is a concern in its own way. What do you make of the top of the West right now? You know, Phoenix is at the top. We'll get to Phoenix in a second. But do you have any kind of concerns about the Warriors, for example? You know, they're back on this whole two timelines thing. Sometimes I watch them and I think I'll never pick against them in a playoff series. Then they lose to the Pistons. Are you concerned about any of these teams? Or is it just like, hey, it's the first 2 weeks of the season, man. Like, none of this is going to hold up.
Well, I think it's maybe a little kind of in the middle of those things. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's meaningless and like none of it matters, because, you know, if you wind up a half game behind another team in the race for home court advantage, like those losses in October count as much as the ones in April. Right. So all of it matters. But I think that what you're seeing is like there's, because of the I guess increase in just like overall talent throughout the league, there are relatively fewer just gimmies and like schedule wins and what you could pencil in for everybody. So like even a bad team can jump up and bite you if you're not like all the way there. I mean, the fact that you're seeing like the Spurs and Jazz are combined 10-4 right now, you know, like we all projected those teams to be near the bottom of the league, but there's, you know, there's quality even, and even like the bad teams are interesting. Like Detroit can beat you, Indiana can beat you, Orlando's got young legs, etc. So like there are opportunities for good teams to take bad L's in that context. And I think in the West it's like as tightly packed as it is, like you still have teams that are a lot, even those, the good teams are still figuring things out. Like you mentioned the two timelines issue in Golden State, where they're going to keep giving minutes to James Wiseman. Like he's a number two pick. He is somebody that is a vital piece of the long-term plan there, whether or not the immediate results suggest that he needs to be right now. So they're going to give him a chance. They're going to like, and maybe whether that's Steve Kerr kind of showing Joe Lacob, like, I'm going to, you give me enough rope, I'm going to show you how we're going to hang ourselves here. And then once you see it, I'm going to stop playing him and we're going to go to the rotation that I want. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But they're going to have to like get reps to figure it out. Denver, the questions there are just like, you're reintegrating Michael Porter Jr., you're reintegrating Jamal Murray, and with a couple of other new pieces, like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Bruce Brown, and now what's our defense? Can we get to where we need to be defensively? And some nights they look like they can, and then other nights not so much. And I mean, they're bottom six in defense right now. So like, even teams that we expect to be good still have questions to answer, and this is sort of the question-answering time of the season. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks ago, everybody was undefeated, and we all thought everybody thought they were going to go to the championship. And now we're seeing kind of where the rubber meets the road. And that gives, I think, some of those teams that have a little more stability in what they, what the rotation looks like, what the roster looks like, what the scheme looks like, makes it a little bit easier for them to maybe get out fast, which is, as you mentioned, you know, the Suns, for all the chaos they had this summer and for all the Sturm and drama about what that was going to look like, they know how to play together. And so, I mean, you might be seeing some of that pay dividends now.
What do you make of this Warriors 2 timeline idea. You know, the Wiseman minutes generally have not been great this season. The defense has been an issue. Kuminga's been a little bit in and out of the rotation. They seem to be like, you know, kid gloves for Wiseman, higher expectations for Kuminga, Moody a little bit the same. Like, you know, it's tough. He's stuck behind Thompson and Poole to an extent. His minutes also come and go. Again, like, this is a team that when Steph, Clay, and Dre have been in a playoff series, the last time they lost with the three of them together was the 2016 Finals. Do you still see them as, like, a title favorite in the West, your title favorite in the West? Do you think that they maybe need to consolidate? How do you feel generally about their kind of plan there?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if by the time the games really count, the only one you're seeing in a rotation role from that young group is Moody. I think that, like, it seems like Kerr trusts him a lot more than he trusts the other young guys, and part of that's a function of just, like, being able to defend multiple positions and shoot the average from three. Part of it is, I think, if their front court rotation's healthy, I can absolutely see a scenario where it's just, like, we're going to lean on Looney and Draymond at the five, and we're going to have Jamichael Green kind of be the swing big, depending on what our lineups need there. And so then you're not going to need a whole lot of minutes in a playoff series from Wiseman or, you know, Kuminga as, like, a, you know, sort of jolt at the four, because Kuminga's probably best served playing either as a backup four or, like, a small ball five. And they don't really, with the way the roster's constructed, like, they're trying to jam him in as a small forward sometimes, and that's the positionality of that just doesn't really work so much. I'm less concerned about it, because I feel like this is maybe the laboratory portion where, all right, we're going to give the guys a chance, but when it's you're down to a playoff series or you're down to sort of nitty gritty, I don't think you're going to keep seeing. I mean, barring a major leap from Wiseman, like. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Like, it's hard to blame him. He's still so young. He's played so little high-level basketball between that, you know, only a couple of games at Memphis before that season ended, before the injury in his rookie season, not being back at all last season. There's just so few opportunities for him to develop that. But some of those things are also just feel for the game issues, and they're not, like, the light can come on sometimes a little bit later for bigs. And so it's like, if the best case scenario for what he provides right now is, like, mega JaVale,
yeah,
might be sort of what his best case scenario is right now. That can still be a useful player, but if he's providing that and also, like, jumping for every block and getting out of position, not being able to defensive rebound, all those sorts of things, when the games matter, Kerr's not going to stand for that.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, and if you've, you know, constricted your rotation down to the guys who have been there before, and you're relying on with Moody being kind of the new arrival in that way because he's the easiest fit as a smart high level defensive wing, I still like what they got, but it requires a lot from Steph, but, you know, then so it, they have always required a lot from Steph.
It's very interesting. Wiseman's definitely a lot further along offensively than defensively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to get back into that preseason conversation, but it is interesting against the backdrop of what happened with Draymond this summer. No extension, the pool punch, etc. Like, I think that they are counting on Wiseman, Kuminga to step up and fill aspects of that role. I think Draymond's been really good to start the season.
He's been great.
He's, like, locked in on both ends. There are just some moments. Like, I was watching that Hornets game, and he's just berating Mason Plumlee at the free throw line, like, getting into the refs, and it's like just veering on, like, this guy is so grating, but then he's just perfectly positioned. He has five fouls, but he makes an incredible steal, and it's like, you just cannot replace that, even though I think they really would like to for a lot of reasons.
To that point though, so we talked in the Brooklyn section, we were talking about, like, at what point is the juice not worth the squeeze sort of on the play, right? And Draymond is sort of the other end of that spectrum. Like,
yeah.
Because what he gives you is that identity. He gives you that defensive spine. He gives you that we are going to all reach the same standard. Now, that does not excuse by any means what he did to Jordan Poole. It doesn't excuse by any means what that sort of behavior has been and some of the other blowups that he's had in the past. But when you talk about, like, why everyone goes to the mat for him in Golden State, it's because of that. Like, I think you can – obviously, Stephen Curry is the prime mover in all those situations. And, like, the reason that that is a $7 billion franchise and a four-time champion and everything is Stephen Curry. But if they don't have that defensive identity and that ability to be – everyone's not on time, on target with their rotations – expected to perform to a certain level, and if they don't, they will not play and they will not last. Draymond provides that. And so that's where then the young guys who can reach that level will play and the ones who can't don't. And so that's why I think part of it is you bet on that, because when all else fails in Golden State, you know what they can fall back on. And the guys who provide that are still there at a really high level.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And that's why I think they're going to be, I think I tweeted this with, like, I picked the Nuggets to make the finals, but I don't see myself picking any team to beat Golden State when it comes down to it, just because of that. Those guys, like, I need to see them get knocked off before I can believe it's a reality. I do want to talk about the Suns, who are 5-1, I believe have a top three net rating in the NBA. I say I believe because even though a simple Google search would have sufficed. I don't do it. I never do it until the absolute last second. They've been really good. I think Devin Booker's been fantastic. Pairing and I talked about, like, emerging legend Jock Landale. Phoenix has the number one net rating in the NBA, by the way, 12.3. I mean, it's been only six games. But they win last night without DeAndre Ayton. Bismack Biyombo starts in his place. They've been good. Herring made an interesting comp. We didn't talk too much about the Suns last week, but he was like, I think he mentioned them in relation to the Utah Jazz. Like, is this the team that maybe is just destined to be good in the regular season, but no one believes them in the playoffs? I thought that was interesting. I mean, Phoenix did at least make the finals. But they were like a bottom of the list of vibes headed into the season. Like,
that's right.
It was a real disaster. And they've looked really good. The starting five has been brilliant. Devin Booker's been really good. Like, they're getting really good bench play from Damian Lee. I mentioned Landale. Damian Lee's been spectacular for them. Torrey Craig's been really good for them. They've been able to overcome the kind of Jay Crowder situation there. Your thoughts on the Suns so far, you're just kind of level in confidence in them after, albeit, only six games.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was a little low on where they were going to come in because the idea of, even if you don't think Jay Crowder is like a champion maker, right? And, mm-hmm. and you know, like...
it was a significant rotational loss at the end of the day. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, well, what are they going to replace him with? They're going to replace him with Torrey Craig and Damian Lee. And I was like, Damian Lee, who the last time we saw him was, he was not able to be... on the floor for the Warriors in the playoffs. Yep. Like, they didn't trust him there. I was like, I know, how good can you feel about that? And the answer is pretty good.
Hard
to argue with what you've seen so far. And, like, I mean, the fact that they've gotten out to where they are offensively with Chris Paul shooting like 35% from the floor, I think bodes really, really well. They're obviously, there's still an opportunity for them to make a move, make an addition with all those picks that didn't turn into Kevin Durant in the summer. And, you know, if you have Crowder to move, you can maybe, find some ways to add depth or add help. Although obviously, you know, trading kind of present day player for present day player is a little bit tricky, but there might be some flexibility and optionality, especially if guys like Craig, like Damian Lee are able to bolster that second unit. But I think, you know, so much of it is, I think the Utah comparison is apt. But I also think that it's difficult to denigrate them as a result of, like, well, that team fell apart. You know, the Utah team fell apart. It reached a point stylistically where they could go no further, and that was it. And Phoenix, theoretically at least, because of Aiden's greater versatility as an offensive mm-hmm. player than Gobert.
Booker is better than Mitchell. Paul is still a plus, yeah.
Yeah, like a higher end facilitator and table setter mm-hmm. than Mike Conley at this stage. Like, there's just, if that team is better and has more answers, then you're a little less worried about them, crumbling in that same way. That said, there's also, there is a similarity in the Utah comparison of, like, no one's going to care until May, right? Like, there is nothing that this, and like the Bucks before them, there is nothing this team can do to affirmatively assuage your concerns or, like, really, you know, solve all the problems with until you reach a playoff series where they're down or, you know, like they're facing a bad matchup and how do you deal with it? It's hard to blame them for not being able to stop Giannis because no one was able to stop Giannis in that playoff run. Like eventually a battering ram just breaks you down.
Yeah.
It's hard. There's on some level, it's also hard to say like, well, when Luka just does whatever insane stuff Luka's doing, difficult to do that. But like, you're going to have to beat a few of those guys to get there.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to face some adversity and some disadvantageous situations and come through them to be able to do that. We're not going to be able to tell if they're capable of doing that over the next few months. But the fact that they haven't gotten out of the gates slowly and gotten beat up, like that initial, that opening night where they were getting smacked around by Luka again. And it was like, oh man, is this the start of something really bad? For them to have bounced back from that in such a big way indicates like, all right, at least this is not like a team that doesn't believe in itself anymore. And that can carry you a long way.
Definitely. It's tough. You know, I really believed in the Suns last year. And so I don't know if it's like, I just don't want to get hurt again, that I'm trying not to get my hopes up, but I think this version of Devin Booker that we've seen, again, with the caveat being that it's only six games, I think it's the best version of Devin Booker we've seen. Ayton, you know what's funny about Ayton is that he's like never really averaged more than 30 minutes a game. You know, part of that's foul trouble, big man, et cetera. But, you know, if they push him up to like 34, 35, like he's someone who I think will show his production will go up. I don't think it's going to dip. So there's like, you know, internal improvement is also still on the table for them. Cam Johnson has been fantastic in the starting lineup. People were worried about, is the defense going to tank when they put him in for Crowder? That hasn't been the case. He supercharged the offense. The defense is holding up. So there are reasons to be excited about them, divorced from the context of their last couple playoff exits. They're going to be really interesting. I think they're going to be really interesting. I don't know that they'll finish with the best record in the NBA again or have the best net rating all season, but you know, I think of all the teams that kind of really needed a good start to the season after what happened to them last year, they were at or near the top of the list. And I think at least in terms of that, like they've answered that question so far, right? Like, was this team going to fall apart? Were the vibes so bad that, you know, they could have easily blown that opening night game against Dallas. They had a really, really nice win over Golden State. So I think that they've at least answered all the early season questions that they could have.
Yeah, as many questions as you can answer to this point, they have. I mean, and even like the expected regressions might level out. Like you expect that, you know, Mikal Bridges is not going to shoot 63% from the floor all season, but you also expect that Chris Paul's not going to shoot 35. So like somewhere in the middle there, you're still going to have the ingredients for a really potent offense, a well-drilled, competent professional defense that can get stopped at a high level. And then it comes down to just in the course of a playoff series, is Chris Paul going to have enough gas in the tank at the end of the season? Is Booker going to be able to be that a number one scorer to take over game late? And are you going to be able to stay big with Ayton and, you know, use that as like a mismatch in your favor as opposed to when a team wants to go small, spread you out and try to beat you that way? And we've seen examples of that working. I worked against the Clippers a couple years ago. We've seen examples of it not working against Dallas in the playoffs. And so styles make fights. Matchups can be really can sort of tell the tale. But I think you have to like what you've seen from them so far.
Let's switch to the team that's, you know, from the team that's top in net rating in the West to the team that's top in net rating in the East. That's the Cleveland Cavaliers. They're like this only one loss, 5-1 so far this season. Really, really nice win against Boston a couple nights ago. Donovan Mitchell and Caris LeVert both just kind of went nuclear in that game. Mitchell just continued that hot streak against the Knicks last night. That was a really, really nice game from him. Come from behind win for the Cavs. And they're doing this largely without Darius Garland, who I believe got hurt first game of the season with that eye injury. He's been out since. Mitchell has been fantastic. Let me back up before we even really talk about what the Cavs have done so far this season. What was kind of your expectation for them headed into this year? Because I still had them kind of behind the Milwaukee, Boston, Philly class. I even had Brooklyn in there, I think. I'm definitely out on Brooklyn. Phillies, it's been up and down as well. Where were you on Cleveland before the season?
Yeah, I think I had them as sort of like a second tier team in the East. Like there was you know, the idea of generally Boston and Milwaukee were kind of above everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then there were, you know, five or six teams, any of whom could win 50 games or find themselves in the play-in. And it wouldn't necessarily surprise me. I thought that Mitchell made a lot more sense for Cleveland than he did for New York at that sort of price point, because the idea was, if you bring Mitchell to New York and you sort of give up everything it's going to take to get him there, who's the supporting cast that elevates him or that he can elevate? And if you do it in Cleveland, it's like, well, you already have the backbone of a top five defense there with Jared Allen and Evan Mobley. You already have an all-star level, another all-star level creator in Garland. So like, he makes a lot more sense as a how do we tack on a top five offense to this existing core, as opposed to how do we, like, can this be the thing that lifts us up? And then I say all that, and then I watch him just absolutely flame broil the Knicks defense and go like, well, maybe it would have been okay to give up the extra picks. You know, like,
right.
Maybe we can't argue about that too much. I think it's been extremely encouraging to see how well he's played. Like, it wasn't just, any concerns that you might have had about, like, was it about just the shooting they had around him and the Rudy Gobert screen and roll of it all and the way they could sort of have that engine of a system? Is that what made Donovan Mitchell? The answer is no. Donovan Mitchell made Donovan Mitchell, and that's going to that travels. That goes to different places. I think the sort of outstanding concern, as you mentioned, they've barely played together, Mitchell and Garland, because of that eye injury on opening night, the first game of the season. So they've been able to defend at a really high level with Mitchell on the court. Not necessarily surprising. The Jazz have been able to do that as well. And as long as you've got Allen and Mobley, you should probably have a pretty strong defense. But when the backcourt is Mitchell and Garland, and you've got sort of two smaller guards back there, what's the math on that? How do you, can you avoid mismatch hunting? Can you be able to support those guys enough? That question of like, who's the three next to them is going to remain, I think, a big one throughout the season. LeVert is going to play a role there. Isaac Okoro may be playing himself out of a role there. But Dean Wade is somebody that they go back to that kind of like three big look that they had last year with Markkanen, and before that, even with Larry Nance in kind of small minutes there, another kind of jumbo wing. Dean Wade provides that. And that, like, when you've got bigger, you got size sort of all across those three front court positions, it makes it a little bit easier to play two small guys. But I think that's sort of the big remaining question. But I think that offense is going to be able to cook against just about anybody. And if they're able to, and if Mitchell is, like, we've seen Mitchell put up big performances in the playoffs against really good defenses, even when they're sort of geared up to stop him. So if you've got that and another, like, release valve offensive option in Garland, able to, you know, if you trap the ball out of Mitchell's hands, you've got another guy that you love the feeling of him going 4-on-3 and vice versa. It just provides more optionality for that offense. It provides more avenues of attack. And as the shots keep falling, like, that's a dangerous, dangerous team.
For sure. I thought Mitchell had gotten a little underrated after the last postseason. And listen, that was largely his fault. He was very bad in that Jazz series, in that Mavs series, particularly defensively. The effort was just not there. At the same time, you know, colleagues, I don't know that this trade moves the needle for Cleveland. I remember telling the old co-host of this podcast, I thought Cleveland could make the conference finals at some point. He's like, no way. I think the Hawks are going to be better, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, this guy was
best. That's a good impression of him, by the way.
Yes,
he sounded exactly
you.
Like
thank
him.
You. Yeah, I thought so. People are going to be like, he's back on the podcast? he was the best offensive player on the best offense in the NBA. Like, you can't just swap him out with anybody, and Utah's offense is that good. You mentioned Isaac Okoro, who's kind of maybe played his way out of the rotation. We talked about him over the summer. Like, I hope that guy took 10,000 corner threes over the summer.
Right.
It hasn't quite been there for him shooting-wise. They started Dean Wade in that Boston game as kind of the three. I do wonder if this team, like, if they made a trade, like, oh, man, like, if they had somehow been able to get Otto Porter this offseason too, like, it feels like they're just so close to being a 1-3-D small forward away, and you could say that for a lot of teams. I mean, that's the guy every team in the league wants. But God, I like, you know, if they got Jay Crowder, for example, I know he's not like a knockdown shooter, but I think he also has more gravity. You know, like, at the end of the day, it's like sometimes it's less about even making shots and more like, will this team respect his shot? Will this team close out on him in a game six? And like, Jay Crowder may not be a great shooter, but I think when it comes to like a high leverage moment, like an opponent is going to be a half step closer to him or a full step closer to him than they would say Isaac Okoro or even Dean Wade. And I just wonder if there's a guy out there for them who, because if they got that kind of player, like I could see them making conference final this season. I mean, Boston's obviously been very good. Their defense is going to get better, but their defense has been bad to start the season. Philly is kind of, you know, they have concerns, particularly again on the defensive end, how it's all going to come together offensively for them. Like, yeah, I just think Cleveland has like actually a really good roster. LeVert is, I think, a decent option to have off the bench. I'm wondering if there's that small forward out there for them.
Well, selfishly, I kind of hope the answer is no, not because I, you know, want them to not succeed, but because I want to see from a problem-solving perspective what it looks like in the course of a playoff series where the answer to that question is Evan Mobley. Like, if you know, you were talking earlier about like it's frustrating when teams start a lineup that they think has no, they really kind of know has no shot, or schematically it doesn't make any sense for how it would work. There's a chance that to get the best five on the court in, you know, the second half of a playoff game, it's going to require like Allen, Love, Mobley, Garland, Mitchell, or something like that, right? And so then you look in that matchup and you're like, well, who on that team's guarding Tatum, or who on that team is guarding, you know, insert Jimmy Butler, insert a big wing scorer here. And the answer to that might be Evan Mobley. And we don't know what his ceiling is because obviously it's still so early in his career, but those are the sorts of moments that kind of A, provide like data points about it, but also it gives a talent the opportunity to stretch and figure it out. And I think one thing we've learned about J.B. Bickerstaff as a head coach, going back to his time in Memphis and the way he's organized his teams over the last couple of years here in Cleveland, like he's willing to do something that seems unconventional to try to either wrong foot an opponent or get his best five on the floor. And I think he's got a ton of trust in Mobley, or he has certainly evinced that over the course of Mobley's career so far. Like, I'm going to show that I'm going to put this kid at the top of the zone and tell him to be Kevin Garnett, you know, like that kind of thing. So if that's the case, and if there is that feeling of confidence and there is that sense of this might be our best chance, like we can maybe bully ball them on the glass if we go bigger and then just like trust Mobley to go do that. If you have a, perfect plug and play 3-and-D wing, great. I'm certainly not going to argue with that. But if they don't find that, if it's not the right trade package, because obviously they sent so many picks out the door in the Donovan Mitchell deal, you know, whatever the case may be, I would be pretty interested in seeing what it looks like when they try to problem solve with what they've got on hand, because I think that Mobley's the kind of talent that demands opportunities like that.
It's very interesting, and that's a good point. You know, I was watching that Cavs-Celtics game over the weekend pretty closely, and I do think it's interesting how Mobley, as you mentioned, they're using him like Kevin Durant, top of the zone. He's still right now, we talk about him as one of the best defenders in the NBA. He's more of a Robert Williams than a perimeter stopper, right? He plays free safety. He kind of roams around, comes off ball, finds all these other ways to mess up what you're doing offensively, but he has not become kind of the classic perimeter stopper yet, where you throw him on someone and say, hey, like, we can't let this guy score this possession. You need to find every way to stay on him and slow this person down. That's not really been his game. It would be sick if it was. Like, if he could do that too. I mean, I certainly think he has the athleticism for it. I mean, Robert Williams is so good. I think Mobley still has better, you know, lateral quickness, agility, those kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, will the shooting be enough in those lineups as well?
It's a good question.
He certainly is not like, it's not like he's chucking up threes, but he's someone who's not afraid of that shot. Like, he will take it. He'll take even early shot clock ones, pull-ups, etc. Like, you know, I think he wants it to be part of his game, which I think is a good sign for someone of his age. So that's a really, I think, interesting way to look at it, is do they kind of move him down, play Love in these lineups as well, and again, like, just play super big. It's always fun when they do it. It's just we haven't seen that kind of stuff work in the playoffs lately, so you just immediately kind of question it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hope, if you're them, is that, like, Boston provided a blueprint, and, you know, you don't necessarily draw one-to-one analogs, but, like, they were elite last year playing Horford and Robert Williams together. And so then you say, like, well, what's our flavor of that? What's our version of that? And, you know, who's the queen that you can move around the chessboard? I'm interested in what happens when you get all that offensive talent on the floor at one time that can all sort of fit into different roles and different sort of buckets. Like, you get Allen as the screen and dive big man who can hammer the offensive glass and also can, like, mash a post up if you need him to. Like, he's not an elite player down there, but he's able to get that, you know, like, half hook off and kind of be comfortable in that range, further than arm's length away from the basket. And Mobley can be that connector in the middle of the floor, you know, like making the extra pass, short rolling, you know, cutting behind the play on the baseline if he's stationed in the corner. When you've got different types of playmakers and then you've got two, like, full-blown alpha creators like Mitchell and Garland, there's just a lot of ways to skin the cat. And I think that what the early going from them, we've seen there's going to be, like, Mitchell's going to hit the ground running. He's that skill set, high volume pick and roll, high volume pull up 3-point shooting, get to the rim, you know, keep defenses off balance. He's going to be efficient scoring no matter what. Where the rubber's going to meet the road for them is how the interplay kind of comes together. And I think they've got the pieces to be at.
Right. Dan, before we get out of here, I do want to put you on the spot about one thing that I didn't tell you I was going to ask you, but I'm just curious. Did you make a finals pick before the season?
I did. So I never used to have to do this. I was at the Ringer for the last few seasons and there wasn't, like, a preseason picks thing. But then when I got back to Yahoo Sports, they were like, all right, so let's get your picks in.
Yeah.
If I remember right, it was, and I will have to go back and, like, find the social media graphic. I think it was Bucks Warriors. Because, and it's funny, as you were saying, you were like, I got to a point where I picked the Nuggets to make the finals. I was doing the same thing. And then I was like, but if we get to Nuggets Warriors in the Western Conference finals, the matchup is so bad for Denver. I don't know that I can pick them. So even though I didn't feel super good, especially that was, like, the morning after the punch, I really didn't feel good about it. But then it was like, all right, well, I guess that's what I'm going to do. So I think I had Bucks Warriors.
Okay. Would you stick by that after six games? Or are you teetering a little? I mean, the Milwaukee, we haven't talked about them much on the podcast so far this year. They've been fantastic. The defense has been otherworldly. Giannis, I think, is well on his way to winning a third MVP, and this is all without Chris Middleton or Joe Ingles. They've been truly fantastic. I picked the Bucks to come out of the East. I'm feeling great about that. But do you still feel good in your finals pick?
Yeah, in part because it doesn't matter. It's all it's all ephemeral nonsense. It doesn't matter at all. True. And in part because I think while I'm always open to seeing who the next team is that's going to, like, prove themselves in that capacity. Like, we've seen Milwaukee do it. We understand what that team is when it's got the full concept together. The fact that they've looked this good, although the offense has been shaky, but the defense has been sensational, that they've looked this good without two of their top three wings, right? So, like, that's, I think, only going to help them when they get their full complement of guys back. And then Golden State, I don't have, unless they, like, lose enough that they're going to be, like, fighting out of the play-in, which I don't anticipate. I feel pretty confident in that core against just about anybody, because I think what we saw in the playoffs last year was a sort of, like, a corrective and a reminder of what that offense does to opponents in the playoffs. they play differently than everybody else. And then it's like water hitting a rock. It's erosion. By the end of the series, you're just, like, worn off. And they hammer you with that movement and make it so hard to cover everything. And then before you know it, you're giving up backdoor cuts, you're giving up layups. So I think, like, I will need to see that not succeed against some more conventionally built teams before I pick against it, I think.
I could not agree with you more there. Like, Steph has been really, really good to start the season, you know, even as the team's not been great. And that's the thing, is that what I made that joke about, I couldn't see myself picking the Warriors to lose, is just, you pick the team and I'm like, do they have enough that Steph won't wear them down? Like, it's, you mentioned the offense, like, it's all built around this one guy and his ability to shoot from literally anywhere on the court and the amount of emotional labor that requires, like mental fortitude to stay on every movement, every cut, every screen. The idealized version of the Clippers, I think, is the team built best to slow it down. But does that exist? Like, does that team even exist anymore?
Yeah, man. I mean, that's something I want to take a closer look at this week. I might write about it. It's just sort of like, yes, we understand that the Clippers aren't going to be the Clippers until Kawhi Leonard's on the court regularly. And until Kawhi Leonard and Paul George are on the court together for an extended period of time, we won't know for sure what they look like. But their offense still shouldn't look like this. Like, why are they are last in turnover rate? Why is this team, like, even with a representative top 10 kind of defense, why is this collection of talent still not getting to the rim, still not getting free throws, still not, like, Kawhi's not going to fix all of that. Or he is, I don't know, and we'll find out. But I think you're absolutely right. You say, like, the best case scenario for dealing with that kind of defense or that kind of offense is, can you switch everything with total confidence? And the Celtics were as close as we could get last season, but obviously Robert Williams' injury and his inability to consistently be able to be there hurts a lot. The Clippers, if they go five out and they can switch everything that way, that goes a long way toward it. But we just... Even the best, like, you know, those Rockets teams that were purpose built for that exact idea, it just eventually the pressure of doing it possession after possession, game after game, just breaks you. And so it's a different kind of dominance, but it's dominant. And so, like, I think you're absolutely right to say it's about, you need the team that has the horses and also the mentality. And as you look around the West, it's like, I don't know that I see anybody that has that, or that, where I've seen the evidence of that just yet.
It's funny. I don't want to spoil it because I'm writing a story, but I asked a player on a Western Conference contender recently, like, are you guys building your defense to stop the Warriors? And he was like, no, not really. And I was kind of like, shouldn't you be? Like, isn't that?
Why not?
I name checked. I was like, you remember that Rockets team? They said all year long, like, you know, it's like, that was the most, like, Jeff Bidzelic, like, the most anyone's ever talked about an assistant coach ever, was like, this guy was the architect of the defense that they built from day one to play the Warriors in a playoff series. And that was, the best, like, defensive series anyone's played against the Warriors, you know, since this run started. I mean, obviously they didn't win, but they pushed them, you know, to the very limit. And sometimes I'm like, just thinking of teams, like, why aren't teams still doing that? Like, why are you still ignoring the inevitability of the Warriors? And just to go back to the Clippers specifically for a second, you mentioned the offense. Them and the Lakers are far behind the rest of the league offensively. Yeah. The Lakers, 100.3 offensive rating. The Clippers, not much better, 101.3. The next lowest team is the Houston Rockets at 107.3. The Rockets are closer to having, you know, a top 15 offense than the Clippers and Lakers are to the Rockets. Like, it's crazy. And for the Clippers, like, if you have that much shooting, like, you know, their whole thing, like, as you mentioned, like, they can go five out even without Kawhi. Like, they theoretically should have enough 3-point shooting that there's enough space for whoever's on the floor to get good looks, or they just need one guy able to collapse the defense. That not being there is a little, like, a pretty serious concern for me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, it is possible that we look at it 3 months down the line after they've won, you know, 30 of 35 once Kawhi is operational. And we're like, well, that was all silly. But I think the longer you go without feeling confident that he's going to get fully operational, and the more you see, like, the underlying stuff doesn't work quite as well without him, like, they were a team that won a playoff series without him down the back stretch of it 2 years ago. So, like, if you have the bulk of that and you've added talent since then, like, you've added Norm Powell to that, you've added John Wall to that, you've added Covington to that, et cetera, like, you should be even better than that. And for it to just be so misfiring makes you wonder if there's something sort of something, you know, nastier under the hood there. But so, you know, there's still the glass half full optimism of, like, it's early. We've had guys in and out of the lineup. Shots don't fall, but, you know, that'll regress. We'll get warm, yada, yada, yada. But, like, it starts to get late early, especially in a conference as deep as the West.
Very well said, Dan. And I think that is a great note to end this podcast on just an eyebrow raised at some of these teams and their early season struggles. We'll have to check back in 5 months from now just to see if they made us look like idiots or not. Dan, thank you so much for joining the show. Anyone who enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to check out Dan's work on Yahoo Sports. He does such a great job there. They got a really good team, including our old friend Jake Fisher, Vinny Goodwill, as you mentioned. That'll do it for today's episode, though. Hope everyone has a safe and fun Halloween. Until the next episode, everyone continue to enjoy the NBA season.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.